to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the latest episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast. Thank you for all the great feedback from the Fluffy Pony interview last week. I think that was a pretty good one. And I appreciate everyone who got in touch and shared that out. I've got another great interview this week. I've got a lawyer. I've got Jake Chavinsky from Cobra & Kim, someone I've been following and talking to for quite some time. This is a really solid interview. But before I do talk about that, I do want to tell you about my show sponsor. And as I said last week, please do check them out. Please do give them some time. Don't just skip past this, because these are the people who pay for me to keep the show going. So let's talk about BlockFi, who offer crypto-backed loans. If you're holding onto crypto, you can put your Bitcoin and Ether to work without selling. BlockFi gives cryptocurrency owners access to cash through lowest-cost cryptocurrency-to-dollar borrowing. BlockFi have created a special offer to listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you will get $25 in free crypto added to your collateral balance for loans under $10,000, or $50 in crypto for loans over $10,000. And applying should only take you around 2 minutes. So please go and check those guys out. BlockFi is spelt BLOCKFI. So that's blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. Okay, so onto the show. Look, this one is super interesting. I've wanted to do it for a while. Jake's a pretty smart guy. He's always tweeting out about things related to the regulatory side of crypto. He seems like one of the most knowledgeable guys in the space. So yes, I've been talking to him on and off for a while, and he's been a big supporter of the show, which I appreciate too. And if you don't follow Jake on Twitter, I recommend you do. I will share his details out in the show notes, but he provides some pretty high-level insights. He pretty much covers all regulatory items that hit the news affecting crypto. Well, certainly the main things. I've learned so much from him, so getting him on the show was really great. We discuss a lot in this. This is a monster episode. We do a good hour and 20 minutes, and I think this is the longest I've recorded. But it's all worth it. Loads of useful information in here. We get in lots of detail about the SEC, what they are, what powers they have, what their remit is. We discuss what a security is and why it's so relevant to crypto and token issuances. We talk about what's happened with Shapeshift recently, what happened with Eric Voorhees. There's some really interesting points on that and why they had to create custom accounts. We discuss ETFs, we discuss BACT. We also talk about XRP, lots of people interested in that. And we also talk about what will happen with Bitcoin if it becomes fully private, where that sits with regulators in terms of KYC, AML. So there's lots of useful information here. I recommend you have a good listen. You know, if you've got any questions, you can give me a shout. You're better off following Jake, though, because he's the guy who knows his onions in this space. Okay, so please support the show, and I just want to give a shout out and thanks to the first patrons who signed up. I really, really do appreciate it, especially my first WBD Maximus patrons. That's Seb Wanan, I think I've pronounced that correct. That's Steve Foster and Tony Ruse Manier. Sorry, guys, if I haven't pronounced that correctly, but thank you, you guys. So listen, look, Patreon helps me deliver the show, and I've created a number of tiers for anyone else who wants to get involved. It's funny, when I put the Patreon page together, I didn't know if anyone would care. It's one of those things, you think you'll put it up and you think no one will care, no one will contribute. But I got these first 10 contributions in a week, which is super cool. So look, I massively appreciate that, because this and the advertising really helped me keep this going, as this is pretty much becoming a full-time job. And listen, if you're thinking of becoming a Patreon, please just take a quick look. There's a few options. There's a basic $2 option that gets you access to my Patreon feed. You can come and discuss the shows. If you pay $5, you get an early version of the show without any of the ads. So this week's one went out. So you're going to be listening to this on Friday. It went out on Thursday to Patreons. I'm recording another show tomorrow. That's probably going to go out on Tuesday to Patreons. So if you want the show early without any ads, then you can sign up to that. I do have this WBD Maximalist option. That's $25. If you sign up to that, you'll get to know who I'm interviewing up front. You can also contribute to the show. I share out on Patreon my interview framework. And if you want to contribute to that, if you've got ideas, then obviously that's pretty cool. There are also a couple of advertising options if you can't afford main sponsorship of the podcast, but go and check it out. Just head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Okay, other things you can do if you want to support the show. You can leave me a review on iTunes. I've got loads now, but I want more. So please do. Please head over. If you think I deserve 5 stars, that's very cool. Also, please follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm Steemit. I'm on Medium. My handle on everything is What Bitcoin Did. And if you reach out and chat to me, I'll usually get back to you. Please check out my website. I am gradually updating it. I'm getting rid of the old nonsense content. I'm gradually adding more useful stuff. I'm gradually probably reflecting my moving opinion that's becoming slightly more maximalist. But please check that out. That's at www.whatbitcoindid.com. And also, can you share the show out with your friends and family? I see it every time you tag me in it. It's super cool. I really appreciate it. Last week was actually my record, had a record day. I had my most ever downloads on the day that the Fluffy Pony interview was released. And, you know, a lot of you have helped with that. Look, thanks so much. Okay, one last thing. If you didn't see it, I put out a tweet storm highlighting a number of the cool podcast episodes that came out. I'm probably listening anything between 5 and 10 shows a week now, and I know there's so many out there. I think there's like 50 or 60 crypto podcasts. So look, it's subjective. It's the ones I've listened to, but I am creating this list every Friday. I did one last week, and I will be doing another one tomorrow. I will almost certainly be leading with Marty Bent's amazing interview with Caitlin Long. If you haven't checked that out, if you don't know Marty Bent's Tales from the Crypt, please do. It's awesome, and his interview with Caitlin is an absolute monster. Okay, so let's move on to the interview. I've talked enough, as I do every week. I hope you enjoy the show. If you do have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. You can get hold of me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I will almost certainly reply to you. Okay, enjoy the show. Good evening, Jake. Well, it's evening here in England. What time is it there in New York?
It's a little after 5 p.m. I'm in Washington, D.C., actually.
Oh, yes. Sorry, you're in Washington. But do you also, you spend a bit of time in New York, right?
Yeah, so my firm's headquarters is in New York, so I'm up there fairly often.
Very proud to have you on the show. I think I'm one of your first, so I really appreciate all the work you do. I think you're quite an under... I think you're valued by the people who follow you, but you're an not well enough known resource on Twitter. Hopefully people will follow you. I think this is going to be a very important interview because I've got a lot of questions for you. As you know, my style is to try and ask the simple questions to try and help people understand everything that's going on. And it feels to me that even though we have this borderless crypto, that America seems to be the world police for what's going to happen, especially with the SEC and apart from, say, some rogue small countries like Malta. So I want to get into that. But before we do, I don't usually do an origin story because they usually exist, but it would be great to hear your origin story and how you got into crypto and why it's become so important for you.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you very much for having me on. I'm a big fan, so I'm thrilled to be here. So I am a lawyer in private practice. I work for a law firm called Cobray & Kim, as I said, in Washington, D.C. I focus on government enforcement defense and securities litigation. So I represent individual and corporate clients who are being investigated or prosecuted by the U.S. government for alleged regulatory violations or for alleged criminal conduct. I also represent clients in civil litigation related to similar issues, usually financial services or securities issues. As far as my professional background, so I graduated law school in 2013. I worked for a few years after that for a different law firm in DC, doing mostly anti-corruption and anti-money laundering compliance and investigations. I left the firm and moved to Los Angeles in 2016 to clerk for a federal district judge there. That was a one-year position. So when I finished, I came back to DC and started working for my current firm, which is a litigation boutique specializing in mostly complex cross-border disputes and investigations.
Oh, wow. Okay. So did crypto come to you or did you come to crypto? Like, was it a specific client that raised crypto to you?
It actually wasn't a client. So I sort of fell into it by accident, I guess the way that most of us do. You know, I came across crypto a bunch of times over the last 5 years or so. I think I first came across Bitcoin in 2013 when I was doing some anti-money laundering work at my last firm, and I was looking into FinCEN regulations that had just been passed about virtual currency. And, you know, I wrote like a paragraph on what the regulations were, but it never occurred to me to look into what Bitcoin actually was. It wasn't until last year, 2017, that it really clicked for me. I think the reason, well, a couple of reasons that I find it so fascinating. I mean, first of all, I'm sort of a tech nerd. So as a kid, I was going to computer camp and building PCs and programming websites in HTML and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm certainly not a programmer. But even though I decided to become a lawyer instead of a computer scientist or a software engineer or something like that, I've just always loved technology. So that aspect of the space really spoke to me. At the same time, I really found the economic and monetary aspect aspects of Bitcoin fascinating. So like I said, a lot of my work is in the financial services industry, and most of what I do is adversarial to the government. So when I started learning more about Bitcoin last year, and I was reading Bitcoiners, or I was watching Andreas Antonopoulos videos, and they're talking about things like separating money from state and disintermediating rent-seeking third parties in the finance industry. This stuff was right up my alley. So I think I was primed for that. I think last year I saw a random article about price action and decided, okay, fine, let me figure out what this thing is. And I just couldn't stop for hours and days and weeks reading and learning everything I could about what Bitcoin is, how it works, what the technology is, hashing and digital signatures and proof of work and the scaling debate and all this stuff. Also went down the same odd tangents that we all do with the altcoins. Bitcoin is king. So I've always come back to that. And, earlier this year, 2018, I just realized there was so much going on from a legal perspective that I wanted to make this the focus of my practice. And so I decided to fire up my Twitter account. And here I am.
So you fell down the rabbit hole, as we all do, initially as a personal interest, but then obviously you spotted the commercial opportunity for your firm. And does that mean you are heading up a specific crypto division within the firm?
So we actually have several lawyers who work on crypto. I was lucky to get a job at a firm when I came back to DC that already had a really amazing fintech practice. So just a little bit about my firm. So we focus on international disputes and investigations, but most of our cases deal with allegations of fraud or misconduct, and most relate to financial services. So for example, one of our main areas of practice is defending traders who are being prosecuted for market manipulation, which obviously is going to become an issue. We can talk about that a little later, but I think it's going to become a big issue in the crypto space. So I was lucky to fall into a group of people who are already interested in this space and engaged in the crypto world. We also have a little bit of a different business model from most firms. We tend not to develop ongoing, long-standing relationships with large financial institutions. We also tend to take more risks. We're a little bit more aggressive than some other firms. So whereas a lot of law firms are afraid of getting involved in crypto, my firm is very supportive of my being active on Twitter and learning and writing about the space.
Is that to avoid any form of conflict of interest, those kind of retained accounts?
Yeah, exactly. So we describe it as a conflict-free business model. And
right,
what it does is it frees us up to litigate cases against any number of financial institutions that most Wall Street law firms are already representing in one way or another, and therefore can't take cases against their own clients. We also don't have a transactional or corporate practice. We only do disputes and investigations, which allows us to be a little bit more aggressive with the government. So, some firms are doing government enforcement defense on Monday, and they're at the SEC arguing vigorously about some issue. But then on Tuesday, they're back in front of the SEC begging and pleading to get some other financial product approved. And so they have to maintain more of a friendly relationship with the government. We don't. So that frees us up to be a little bit more aggressive than some firms.
So you're part of the resistance then?
If you want to put it that way, I won't argue.
Okay, so look, there's a lot of people out here who've started to get involved in crypto, Bitcoin, and there's different incentives. Most people have a financial incentive, but a lot of people do love and understand the benefits of the technology, the real world use cases in the likes of Venezuela. I think we read about Palestine this week, but it seems to a lot of people that the SEC are kind of holding the purse strings for kind of future success. But at the same time, I'm not based in the US. A lot of other people aren't based in the US. So can you just, for those who don't understand, tell us who the SEC are, what is their jurisdiction and the powers they have?
Yeah, sure. So the SEC is the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's the federal agency responsible for interpreting and enforcing the federal securities laws.
They don't write laws,
as far as
though,
who they are. They don't write the laws themselves. So they are enforcing laws that Congress has written and enacted that are codified in the U.S. code. The SEC does have the ability to do some of its own rulemaking. So the statutes, like the Securities Act of 1933, has the broad strokes of what the securities regulations should be. But the SEC gets to fill in some of the blanks about the, you know, day-to-day details of how those regulations will be implemented. But you're right, they don't write the laws themselves.
Right. Okay. So right now, I guess a lot of the work being done is to see if crypto can fit within current laws or if new laws are required.
Yeah, I think that's the question for Congress right now. You know, in theory, at some point in the future, Congress could draft a brand new crypto-specific piece of legislation that clarifies some of these issues that right now are still pretty uncertain. But it is also certainly possible that the SEC can handle all of this in their rulemaking authority within the existing securities framework.
Right. Okay. And the extent of the powers they have in terms of if there are people do commit some kind of securities, what would you call it, securities fraud or a break of the security laws? How do you term it?
Well, securities fraud is a specific type of securities violation. So I would say in general, a violation of the securities laws.
Okay. So what powers do they have?
So the SEC has enforcement power to enforce all of the federal securities laws. There are a bunch of different rules that they have passed to implement the statutes that restrict, for example, manipulation, fraud, misrepresentation, failure to comply with some of the affirmative obligations of the securities laws. So, for example, most issuers of securities have to register their security with the SEC. If they fail to register their security, but they promote and sell it anyway, then they may have violated Section 5 and 12 of the Securities Act, and the SEC could go after them for dealing in unregistered security. There's an entire division of enforcement at the SEC that handles this. They have subpoena power. They can bring administrative cases, which are handled sort of in-house at the SEC by administrative law judges, and they can also bring civil or criminal actions.
Right. So this is where we kind of have a gray area with ICOs in that almost no ICOs had registered as a security last year. Probably didn't even realize their security. Actually, it's probably a term that was new to most people last year. I think a lot of people thought these as just monetary tokens, monetary like digital virtual currencies. But now the SEC lenses on them. I guess in hindsight, many of these tokens should have been registered as a security.
Yeah, so I think last year the discussion was a little bit different. I think people at that time were trying to treat these tokens as utility tokens, or maybe they were trying to do their issuance outside the jurisdiction of the SEC by keeping the ICO outside of U.S. borders and conducting the transaction in some other country and screening out U.S. investors. There were also some other mechanisms that folks were trying to use to stop these tokens from being subjected to the securities laws, like SAFT agreements, the Simple Agreement for Future Tokens. And I think that the more we look at these products and the more we consider the existing securities framework, you know, specifically the Howey test, which has gotten a lot of press and a lot of discussion in the crypto space, the more it looks like your average token probably is a security that, assuming it's subject to SEC jurisdiction, should have been registered before it was issued.
Right. But at the same time, it seems like the SEC have only really gone after the outright scams, the obvious scams within the market, and have taken quite a light touch with everything else. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, that's what they've done so far. I wouldn't bank on that being how it goes for the next few years. I think that's going to change, and I think it'll change pretty soon. So you're right that for the last year or so, the SEC was mostly going after outright frauds and Ponzi schemes that were not just failing to comply with the securities regulations, but were being issued by truly malicious actors who were trying to take advantage of and swindle retail investors. That's already starting to change. Just last week, the SEC announced its first action against a crypto company that had failed to register, but did not do any other act of fraud or misrepresentation or anything malicious like that. So I think we're going to see a lot more actions in the future for pure regulatory violations, even where the crypto company was acting honestly and in good faith and was trying to comply with the laws, but simply failed to do so.
But at the same time, I read that any action that is followed with some form of compliance or liaison with the SEC openly doesn't mean they'll actually be closed down or prosecuted. They can actually work with the SEC, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think there's a common misconception in the crypto space that securities enforcement is all or nothing, right? That either you have not committed a securities violation and you're fine,
or you're going to jail,
or you violated. Right, exactly, right. You have to dissolve your company, you have to liquidate all your tokens, and you're going to go to jail. That's not how regulatory enforcement works at all. So let me give you a quick summary of how these things usually work. So you're an ICO. One day, you get a subpoena from the SEC. It says the SEC suspects that you have violated Section 5 and Section 12A of the Securities Act, which is the rules that require you to register a security before you issue it. The SEC subpoena then asks you to respond with a bunch of information and maybe to send them a bunch of documents. And this begins a negotiation between you and the SEC over how this enforcement issue will be resolved. Normally, where this goes is you and the SEC sit down in a conference room across the table from each other, and you negotiate in a typical business-style negotiation where you say to the SEC, here are the weaknesses in your case. Here's why we don't think you can prove in court that we violated the securities laws. They respond, here are the strengths in our case. Here are the weaknesses in yours. You talk about the risk of what will happen if you can't make a deal, which is, if you go to trial and you beat the SEC, they're embarrassed. If you lose, the penalties can be very severe. And then you work out a deal. And the deal usually does not involve you going to jail and dissolving your company, or else you wouldn't make a deal in the first place. So these things all get worked out in a standard negotiation.
Sounds like a plea deal of some kind.
Yeah, it's a negotiation. So the SEC is afraid they're going to lose a trial, or that you're going to reveal that whatever their theory of liability is doesn't hold water. And that's going to screw them up, not just with you, but with every other company that they're saying the exact same thing to in another conference room in another building. They don't want bad precedent created, because it'll mess up their whole enforcement strategy. So usually these cases tend to get settled because it's better for everyone. It's less costly. There's less risk. And usually the settlement, as long as the company is willing to comply with the securities regulations, probably pay a fine, remediate whatever issue there was. So if you didn't register your security, maybe now you have to. But as long as you're willing to play ball in that way, you're probably going to be okay.
And in some ways, I don't know the relationship between the various government agencies, but one thing it appears to be quite good from America's point of view that compared to someone like China is the fostering of innovation, the supporting of capital formation. I guess if they'd have come down hard on every single ICO from day one, it might have not been such an entrepreneurial environment for US ICOs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the SEC understands the potential value of this space, or at least they're trying to. The United States does not want to push entrepreneurs to other countries. The U.S. wants to attract healthy and productive development of any space, right? As you mentioned, innovation is an important issue for the U.S. So what the SEC is trying to do isn't destroy crypto or take control over crypto, like I think some other countries might be trying to do. What they want to do is allow the space to develop in a healthy and safe fashion where the technology can move forward without simultaneously hurting retail investors, which is something that has happened, I think, pretty significantly over the course of the last year.
Okay, and before we move on, just so other people understand, what actually constitutes a security?
Yeah, so basically, all a security is a financial instrument that holds monetary value in some way, and usually, but not always, is negotiable, meaning you can transfer the security between yourself and some other party. So there's sort of three or four main categories of securities. There are equity securities, which are securities where you as the holder own a piece of an underlying asset. So like a share of a company, if you own Apple stock, you own a piece of Apple. That's an equity security. Then there are debt securities, where you don't own any underlying asset, but instead you have invested money in someone else with the promise that they will repay you that money, and usually with interest. So that would be like a corporate bond or a treasury bill. Those are debt securities. Then you have derivative securities, which are, you know, futures contracts, options contracts, swaps. These are securities that derive their value from some other underlying asset. So like we have Bitcoin futures. The futures contract is a derivative security that derives its value from the price of Bitcoin. And then lastly, you have hybrid securities, which sort of combine some elements of these other three categories.
And are there any specific legal requirements for issuing a security in terms of who can, and when you are issuing a security, the specific rules you have to follow up outside of registering the security, as you've already mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, there are a ton of requirements. So, I mean, as you might imagine, right, there are any number of Wall Street law firms that you can pay a lot of money to explain to you how to comply with all the regulations for issuing a security. It depends on what kind of security you want to issue. So, in the usual example, if you're doing an IPO, an initial public offering, meaning you're selling your security to all comers in the general public, anyone who has enough money can buy your security, you're going to have to register it with the SEC. You're going to have to comply with the disclosure obligations of the securities laws. So you have to provide information about who you are, what your business model is, what your assets and liabilities are, what risks face your business. You're going to have to do regular disclosures, quarterly and annual disclosures. So, I mean, there are all of these different requirements in the usual circumstance. Now, there are other types of securities where you don't have to comply with those requirements. For example, there's something called a private placement, which is a security issuance under the SEC's Regulation D, where pretty much if you only sell your security to accredited investors, you enjoy a safe harbor from the securities regulations. You do not need to register. You do not need to do the typical disclosures. That's why we see a lot of securities only getting sold to accredited investors, because it means that the company issuing the security doesn't have to spend the, I think it's on average between $1 and $2 million to do an IPO.
Okay, wow. Okay, and am I right in thinking an accredited investor, the certain rules that you have to earn something like, what is it, like $250,000 a year and have over $1 million in assets or something?
Yeah, it's pretty close to that. I mean, it is basically a wealth test. There are other ways to be an accredited investor. So for example, if you are a registered broker dealer, then you don't necessarily have to meet the wealth requirements. If you're a director or officer of the issuer of the security, you can buy that security. You're accredited for purposes of that issuance. But basically, the accredited investor rules are a wealth test. And there's a lot of controversy about whether and how that that rule should change.
Did I read correctly? This wasn't researching for this interview, but I'm sure a long time ago, this came from something like the 1929 crash or whenever it was, because so many people lost money investing in the stock market. Does it go that far back?
Yeah. So the modern securities framework that we still live with today dates back to the 1930s. It was born, as you said, from the Great Depression. So yeah. So stop me if this sounds familiar to you. So in the 1920s, there was a speculative mania. This was the understanding in the 1930s of how the Great Depression happened. A speculative mania due in large part to easy access to capital, overuse of margin financing, too much hype about post-war economic opportunities, and sort of like a general culture of rags to riches success. The idea was all you have to do is buy these securities and we promise you'll be rich. So all these issuers, came up with these securities and told everyone, just buy these. Don't ask any questions. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. And of course, in 1929, that bubble popped. The reaction to this in the 30s was to say, to prevent another speculative mania like this, we need to close the information gap between issuers and investors. That is to say, there is information that investors should have in order to make an informed decision about the securities that they're buying and holding. And only the issuer has that information, right? Who they are, what their business model is, what their risks are, all that stuff. So the basic idea behind the securities regulations was to make sure that investors have basic information about securities, and then also to prohibit issuers from perpetrating acts of fraud and misrepresentation on the market, which you would think would already have been illegal. But in fact, one of the key things that the Securities Act of 1933 did was to outlaw fraudulent conduct.
Right. But it seems a little bit outdated now. You talk about a wealth test, but it feels like a wealth test without an intelligence test is kind of myopic, especially seeing as, I know some pretty smart people who would not pass the accreditation, but I know some pretty dumb people with a lot of money who could easily lose it pretty quickly. And I guess this is the point now. People are starting to feel like these regulations are outdated and unfair.
Yeah, well, I think I agree with you about the accredited investor rule. I think that is one example of a piece of the securities framework that doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. I think at one point it did. I mean, the idea is that if your investors have a certain level of sophistication, it's okay not to give them this basic information that you would want a regular retail investor to have. And in an earlier era where it really was impossible to conduct due diligence, right? I mean, in the years before the internet, before all the information in the world was at our fingertips, and there really was no way to figure out what an issuer was doing, it made sense to a degree, at least, to exclude people who were not sophisticated investors. I completely agree that the problem is equating sophistication with how much money you have. I don't think that that makes a whole lot of sense. I think most people agree about that. Even the chairman of the SEC, Jay Clayton, recently said that if he could find a way to maintain the same level of investor protections while changing the accredited investor rules, he would do that. So I think it's only a matter of time until we come up with some other way of doing this. I will say, generally speaking, I don't think that the securities laws are so outdated that we need to start from scratch. I think that core concept that it's important for investors to have basic information about the securities they buy and hold, that it's important for market participants like issuers and exchanges and brokers to not commit acts that create systemic risk, right? Using too much leverage and, other practices that got us into the financial crisis, for example, securitizing bad mortgages. These concepts still make sense. It's just a matter of updating the laws for the digital age. There's a lot about the laws that made sense when they were written, but that when you put them into the context of, for example, digital tokens issued on a blockchain in 2018, it just doesn't match up that well.
I think most people feel like the biggest problem with the accreditation is the affordability test, because it's arbitrarily unfair on many people who do want to invest, who do want to have the opportunity to invest in certain things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big problem. I also think another issue is there weren't so many private placements until recent years. It was more expected for a company that wanted to raise capital through a securities issuance to do so through an IPO. But the regulations have become so onerous and the costs of doing an IPO have become so much that many more companies are now staying private and allowing only private equity firms or individual accredited investors to buy their securities. So, you know, I think there isn't much incentive anymore for companies to stay public. We're seeing a lot fewer IPOs. And if not for that, the accredited investor rules might not be that much of an issue because if there were more IPOs, then regular folks like you and me could still get access to interesting securities that are likely to accrue value. But because of how the market is, we're not able to do that.
One of the things I kind of find interesting right now is there are a number of ICOs which issued last year who are now changing the value of the token, the utility of the token in fear of the securities regulations. And at the same time, the industry is trying to find some form of utility outside of Bitcoin. And one of the most interesting areas is also then the tokenization of assets. It's kind of a strange, conflicting story happening.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm skeptical about this concept of doing a securities issuance and then trying to escape liability by converting the token that you use to do that issuance into something else. That's not how liability works, right? You can't, so take the example of a drug dealer, right? You can't just say to the government, hey, I'm going to stop dealing drugs now. Please don't prosecute me for all those times I did deal drugs, right? If you violate the securities laws, you're liable no matter what you do afterwards. You may have less damages because the harm that you have theoretically caused to investors is less because you have stopped promoting this security, but it doesn't change the question whether you are liable or not.
Right. Okay. And then, and also we've seen, I guess, the cloudy gray area around Ethereum, where you'll know better than me, there was some kind of official/unofficial response that it may have started as a security, but now it's decentralized. It isn't a security. And then following that, Ripple or XRP people have gone on the march of decentralization for Ripple, claiming XRP is decentralized. There's almost like a change in narrative there too.
Yeah. Well, we can get into Ripple and XRP in a minute. Let me tackle this Ethereum issue first. So yeah, in June, Bill Hinman, who is the director of the Division of Corporate Finance at the SEC, gave an unofficial statement where he said that in the SEC's view, Bitcoin is not a security and probably never was. And Ethereum, based on the status of the network today, is not a security. But he said, putting aside the question of whether it was a security at the time it was issued. I'm not going to express an opinion now about whether Ethereum was or wasn't a security, but clearly there is a difference between using a crypto asset for the purpose of raising capital to fund the development of a network versus where Ethereum is now, where so many people are building on Ethereum. It does serve a use case. I mean, if you're not a fan of Ethereum, you may disagree with this, but it does serve the use case of paying for transactions on the Ethereum network. So I think it makes sense to consider a framework in which you can have a token that starts life as a security and then evolves over time to become not a security at some point in the future. And that's what Bill Hinman said. You mentioned that it was unofficial, and that's a really good point. This is not the rulemaking that I was talking about that the SEC gets to do. When the SEC makes rules that are binding, they have to go through a whole process that looks a lot like this ETF process we've been following. They have to publish the proposed rule in the Federal Register. They have to solicit notice and comments. They have to issue a formal binding rule. This was just one of the directors saying what his opinion was. He could finish his time at the SEC and someone else could come in and take the opposite view and there would be nothing wrong with the SEC doing a complete 180. So while the securities bar, the securities lawyers who are following the SEC more or less take what someone in Bill Hinman's position says as gospel, it's not something you want to hang your hat on, so to speak.
Next up, I talked to Jake about XRP, ETFs, Shapeshift, and what Bitcoin privacy means for regulators. But before I do, I have a message from my show sponsor. If you're holding onto Bitcoin and Ether and would like to put it to work without selling, then you might want to take a look at BlockFi. If you are bullish on crypto and don't have the cash you need to start a business, finance a home, pay down debt, or anything else, BlockFi can help. It's just a home equity line of credit. BlockFi gives cryptocurrency owners access to cash through the lowest cost crypto to dollar borrowing. With the largest crypto-backed lending footprint in the US, BlockFi offers regulatory compliant loans that can be delivered into your bank account in less than 90 minutes. They are the only cryptocurrency to USD lender to receive institutional investment, enabling them to provide the most affordable and trustworthy lending service within the ecosystem. And they have also created a special offer to listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000. Or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying only takes 2 minutes. Right, okay. I have a feeling you want to talk about Ripple or XRP. Maybe the same thing, maybe not.
Well, okay, so yeah, we can talk about Ripple. I get asked about Ripple more than anything else by far on Twitter.
Well, I think it essentially splits the community. There are staunch advocates of Ripple who will argue against Bitcoin, and then there's Ripple haters. I'm probably in the latter camp. Something I invested in early on and did okay with, but as I've come to understand Bitcoin and crypto more, I like it less. I kind of wish I had Ryan Selkis with me. He'd probably have better questions, but tell me the picture for Ripple and XRP as you see it.
Yeah, and isn't it so funny how so many people in this space started with Ripple and then moved on to something else but still made a boatload of money in the process?
I think there's three. They either start with Bitcoin, Dogecoin, or Ripple.
Right, that's right, for sure. Let me start with a whole bunch of disclaimers because yes. I'm a lawyer and so that's what I have to do. So nothing I say is legal or financial advice. Don't trade or make any financial decisions based on what I'm saying. I have no opinion about whether XRP is or isn't a security. I don't know what's going to happen with Ripple. Okay, I think that does it. You know, one thing that's funny is I have, I'm on Twitter and I have followers in both of those camps you mentioned. I have a lot of fans of Ripple who are following me because I tweet a lot about what's going on with Ripple. And then I have a lot of followers who are more in your camp. So hopefully I won't alienate one or the other when this podcast comes out. The interesting thing about Ripple, and I don't mean to make any statements about the connection between XRP and Ripple. I'll use them interchangeably. But the interesting thing about Ripple is the securities issue related to XRP is already being litigated in state and federal court in California. It's actually furthest along as compared to any other token or ICO or crypto asset in getting to a resolution on this question, whether it is or isn't the security. There are two cases in California state court. There's one in California federal court. All of them basically allege the same thing, that Ripple created, promoted, and sold an unregistered security, that is XRP, that because XRP is a security, Ripple was required to register it first and provide all the disclosures that they're required to provide under both California state and federal law. And by failing to do that, they violated state and federal securities laws. The cases are still very early stage, but at some point, this question will be in front of a judge who, in theory, could say, categorically XRP is or is not a security, or could say this is an issue for a jury to decide at trial. And then we get 12 lay people chosen through the jury selection process in California who get to make the decision whether XRP is or isn't a security. That's unlikely because class action cases, which is what these are, rarely go to trial. But we have started this process of marching toward an answer of what XRP is or isn't. While that happens, it seems to me that the SEC is taking a hands-off approach and just watching the cases develop to see what happens. If Ripple wins, right, if one of these judges writes an order on a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss and says, as a matter of law, XRP is not a security, that's a disincentive for the SEC to take any action. Right. It wouldn't be controlling precedent, but it would be bad precedent. And they don't have time or resources to waste going after something that has been vindicated by a judge sitting on the bench. On the other hand, if Ripple loses or settles, then that would justify an SEC enforcement action after the fact. So I think until those cases move forward, we're not really going to know what the SEC thinks, and we're not going to have any certainty about XRP status.
But at the same time, even if it is considered a security, as we've spoken previously, it doesn't mean the end for Ripple, as XRP haters would want. We would expect possibly a fine, some kind of non-prosecution agreement, or as I think I saw you tweet about, there's a number of avenues for Ripple to carry on, but just face the consequences of previous violations of the regulations.
Yeah, and so they can settle with the SEC. If the SEC were to be investigating them or to be prosecuting them in exactly that way, they could promise the SEC that they're going to register XRP and they're going to comply with all the disclosure requirements and maybe pay a massive fine or a small fine, depending on how good of a deal they can negotiate. And then they can keep doing business. The same thing is true with these class action cases. So it's important to understand the difference. The cases in California are brought by private investors who are taking advantage of a private right of action under the securities laws that allows regular people to file lawsuits for violations of the same rules and statutes that the SEC might launch an enforcement action for. The class action plaintiffs can reach their own settlement with Ripple, where Ripple maybe pays some amount of money in damages to the class action plaintiffs. And if they're able to either reach a settlement or win that case, then in theory, they would resolve this issue for every single investor who's within the class, which would probably be all U.S. investors who bought XRP. And that's gives a lot of clarity to Ripple if they're able to do that.
And referring over to the Howey test, I won't repeat all 4 points here, but just a question I have. Must it meet all 4 points to be considered a security?
Yeah, it does. And so it's actually not that complicated. So the four factors of the Howey test are you have an investment of money, number one, in a common enterprise, number two, with the expectation of profit, number three, based substantially on the efforts of a third party or promoter, number four. You have to tick all four of those boxes to call something an investment contract, which is a type of security.
So does decentralization take you away from common enterprise?
Probably not common enterprise.
Right,
common enterprise is, it's that prong is more about the relationship either between all the investors or between the investors and the issuer. So pretty much a common enterprise is like all of us own the same token, therefore all of our fates are intertwined. If the token goes up, all of us do well. If the token goes down, all of us do poorly. That's a common enterprise. Decentralization is more about that fourth prong, whether you are expecting profit as a result of the efforts of a single third party or promoter. This goes back to the idea of why we have the securities laws in the first place. Investors need information from the issuer about the security. So if you're expecting a single issuer to make you a bunch of money, you need to know from that issuer what's going on with their business. If instead... Right. you are expecting profits because there are 1,000 different companies that are working on this same network. You don't really need information from any individual one of them. It is easier for you to make an informed decision about buying this token or whatever it is without getting that information. So in theory, the more decentralized something is, the less you're expecting profit from the efforts of a single promoter, the less you need the securities laws to apply to protect investors.
Right. So with Ethereum, I understand that because it's an ecosystem, lots of independent companies or coders or developers building on top of that and just creating a whole ecosystem of this kind of unstoppable computer. Whereas if you look at XRP, it's Ripple.
I will leave that to you to decide.
That's my interpretation. Okay, so in terms, therefore, of the ICO landscape, I guess there is still an opportunity for companies to use the ICO as a way of raising funds. But really, for those now considering it, the kind of Wild West is over. A 5-year statute of limitations even affects those previously raised ICOs. But actually, there's a good opportunity for the future. Really, anyone issuing a security now has to have good legal advice before they do it. But it's not actually a closed door, right? It's just follow the regulations.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so one of the other core concepts of the securities laws, and this is something that was articulated by the Supreme Court in the Howey case in 1946, is it doesn't matter what form your security takes. It doesn't matter what you call it. You can issue any kind of security you want to. So if you want to issue a security through an ICO, through a digital token, you are more than welcome to do that. You can issue a security if you want by offering memberships to your gym. You can do a security offering any way you want. It's just when you do it, you have to make sure you're complying with the securities laws. And ICOs are no different. There's no reason to think that they would be.
And how far does the remit go? Because say if I was to issue a security here in the UK, I was to exclude investors from the United States, am I still at risk?
You're always at risk when the SEC is concerned, unfortunately. This is sort of the way that that the U.S. government and its enforcement agencies tend to operate, is if they can assert a plausible justification for jurisdiction over conduct outside of the U.S., they may well just do it to see if they can get a settlement out of you. That's not true for all regulators. I do think there are some really good people over there who understand that United States world police is perhaps not the best way to conduct business. But, it's harder than it seems to stay outside of the SEC's jurisdiction if you're going to do a securities offering. So the SEC explains its perspective on when you do a securities offering outside the United States in its Regulation S. And a lot of ICOs are now trying to comply with Regulation S. Basically, what Reg S says is if you want to stay outside the SEC's jurisdiction, you have to do an entirely offshore transaction, meaning the buyer is offshore, the issuer is offshore, and the transaction itself is executed offshore. That's why a lot of these ICO contracts will have a clause saying, this ICO sale is being conducted in the Seychelles or something like that, no matter where it actually is. And second, you have to make sure you do no direct selling efforts to U.S. investors. So like you said, excluding U.S. investors is the start, but that's not necessarily enough. And the reason for that is, look, if you block IP addresses from the U.S., but you fly to conferences in the U.S. and you promote your token through speeches to U.S. investors at those conferences, and you place advertisements on websites that are seen by U.S. investors, and you do interviews for U.S. audiences telling them that they should buy your token, right? It's not enough just to do the exclusion on the website where the ICO is running. The SEC will see through that. So a lot of the arguments now about how far the SEC's jurisdiction extends is about, in the digital age, how you can truly have no direct selling efforts to U.S. investors when all advertisements online are going to be seen by everybody who's looking at the website. And so I think that is a big issue that still needs to be worked out.
And they're not the only government agency interested in this, right? I mean, I didn't even realize, it's only from looking through your Twitter that I read about, would you pronounce it FINRA?
FINRA, yeah, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority.
Because they've also charged people with issuing securities, right?
So FINRA is a self-regulatory organization, not technically a government agency.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, no, it's a minor technical detail, but they are authorized by Congress to govern the broker-dealer industry. So if you are a broker or a brokerage firm or an investment advisor operating in the U.S., you have to register with FinCEN. They administer qualification exams. You have to pass those. You have to do continuing education for FINRA, all this kind of stuff. And when you do that, you subject yourself to FINRA jurisdiction. And FINRA shares responsibility with the SEC for enforcing a lot of the securities laws. So FINRA will go after its own registered members in the form of disciplinary actions if they violate the securities laws. And sure enough, very recently, FINRA launched its first enforcement action against a broker who did his own ICO, lied to his own clients, investors about it, sold it to them, and didn't register it. So it seems like FINRA is jumping into this space too.
Right. Okay. Gosh, that's a lot to go through. I want to talk to you about the SEC again shortly because I want to ask you about ETS, but I also want to talk to you about Shapeshift. And I have to thank you. You got me a mention on Laura Shin's podcast because you quoted my interview with Eric Voorhees. So KYC, AML, big issue for Shapeshift. What did you make of all that?
Yeah. And my pleasure, by the way. I immediately when I saw the Shapeshift news, I remembered listening to your interview with Eric Voorhees, which was a fantastic interview. You know, this was not a surprise to those of us who are watching this space. We spend a lot of time talking about securities enforcement. Securities enforcement is just the beginning of the vast network of regulations that are going to get applied to this space. Anti-money laundering compliance is as big or bigger of an issue for the future of crypto generally. The securities issue is an ICO-specific problem that really only came up because people realized that the best use case for Ethereum was to raise capital. I think the securities issue will die out, and the anti-money laundering issue is the one that will survive. So basically, here's how this works. We live in a tightly controlled, regulated global financial system, the point of which is to exclude undesirable people and conduct from the system, right? Pretty much to single out criminal conduct and prevent the proceeds of criminal activity from being introduced into the system. That's because if you want to spend money on goods and services in the developed world, you need access to the financial system, which means criminals who are committing crime for the purpose of making money are trying to introduce their funds into that system. The way law enforcement functions basically is to conduct as much financial surveillance as possible to catch criminals at the point of entry of their funds into the financial system rather than detecting the actual crime that they committed, right? So it's easier to catch, for example, a drug cartel by tracking their money than by tracking their drug deals. The issue with cryptocurrency is that it exists entirely outside that regulated financial system. So what Shapeshift was doing was allowing people to convert funds into privacy coins, which are a whole separate issue, without any KYC, meaning basically they could get access to financial products that they could spend for goods and services without ever touching the regulated financial system, without law enforcement being able to understand what they're doing. That is unacceptable to law enforcement as it exists in 2018. So it's no surprise that, and look, I'm just guessing because we don't know exactly what happened with Shapeshift. We know Eric has said basically that he was forced to do this by guys with guns. So we know that there was some elements of pressure from the government, and that's why Shapeshift implemented know your customer requirements. My guess is that FinCEN went to him and said, look, you are a money transmitter. You should be regulated under the Bank Secrecy Act, which defines a money transmitter as a regulated financial institution. That law requires you to implement an anti-money laundering compliance program. The fact that you don't have one is either a civil or criminal violation of U.S. law. And so really, he and Shapeshift would have had no choice but to comply or else get involved in some pretty nasty litigation. So I'm assuming, I don't know, but I'm assuming that's how this went down.
I think guys with guns is his standard description for the government, right? And quite interestingly, you know, there were a lot of people who have, I guess with Eric, you know, an original Bitcoin, an original libertarian has moved into a market which involves trading of other altcoins, which maximalists don't like. So, and then he got involved in the New York agreement, which, you know, irked some people. And there are a lot of people expected him then to turn around to the government and say, no, I won't comply and close down Shapeshift. But it's not just as easy as he is easy as closing out Shapeshift anyway, because am I right in thinking by just closing down could have had other implications that may have encouraged the government to file charges?
Yeah, so I mean, it's the same drug dealer example, right? You can't violate the anti-money laundering rules and then say, sorry, I'll close my business, and then assume the government will just leave you alone. I think the only way to get out of the prospect of liability for that violation was to make a deal, and the deal would have included the government promising not to prosecute. You know, also, Eric has a lot of employees, and I know he's a controversial figure, but I think he's generally a pretty good guy. I think he means well. I don't think he wanted to put all of his employees out of business on principle. I think that if he had closed the business and the stated reason for closing down was, I don't feel like following the law that applies to me, then he would be liable for, at minimum, breach of fiduciary duty. So when you have shareholders, as I'm pretty sure Shapeshift does, you owe them a duty to look out for their best interests. And you can breach that duty if you, you know, if you make a decision that isn't in their best interest, and shutting down your business because you don't feel like complying with, you know, valid laws that apply to you would probably not go over too well.
So I've got an interesting quote from you, and going to lead me on to my next question. I think I'm pretty sure I quoted you as saying this: the concept of anonymous crypto exchanges and transactions is a genuine nightmare for regulators and investigators, and, you know, probably why something like Monero has never made it onto Coinbase, never will. Zcash does, because it's got optional privacy. The KYC AML requirements for Shapeshift, because you could anonymously swap coins into privacy coins. But one of the things being worked on with Bitcoin is full privacy in the future. How do you see that playing out? Because, gosh, if I could see a scenario where companies such as Coinbase are no longer able to list Bitcoin if it has full privacy.
That is a very hard question, and probably my greatest concern about the future of crypto. I mean, you can tell probably by this point, I'm a believer in this. Asset. I think there is very little that can stop it from growing in its adoption rate and its use cases in the world. I think that at this moment, regulators and politicians still don't understand even the basics of what it is and how it works. I think the Congress people who are doing these hearings, they still want to know who the CEO of the Bitcoin Corporation is. Like, they don't get it at all. So I think that they don't have the concept of, for example, Lightning Network delivering a categorically different level of privacy to Bitcoin. I don't think that's something that they're thinking about right now. If they were, and when they do, I think that that will be very frightening to them. As I said, the way that law enforcement operates right now is basically by being totally dependent on financial surveillance and catching criminals by their movement of money rather than by the crimes that they're committing. That is only increasing as time goes on and as we move further away from a cash-based society. I think the idea that we will go back to a world where the government cannot detect crime by analyzing our financial behavior is a very scary thought for law enforcement. And, you know, look, the idea does make some sense, right? You're trying to make it so that crime doesn't pay, make it harder for criminals to enjoy the fruits of their crime. If you can't spend your money because you can't get it into a bank, then you're maybe less incentivized to commit crime in the first place. That said, this system comes at great cost to our privacy. And I think that it is possible that we will be able to impress upon regulators and politicians how important it is that we have privacy. This is a growing issue now. You can see with hearings related to Facebook and Twitter, people are starting to be more vocal about the idea that we do not want the government to know everything about us at all times. And our financial behavior, really, it goes to the core of who we are, right? You can learn everything about a person by how they spend money. And so my hope for Bitcoin is that either we can convince the people in power that they should allow, I shouldn't say allow because they don't really have control over it in the first place, but that they should not attempt to stop adoption of Bitcoin on the basis of the fact that it delivers privacy, which in the US is supposed to be guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Or secondly, we simply need to get Bitcoin adopted fast enough that it plays an important enough role that it would be impossible to attempt to stop it. That is essentially what happened with the internet, right? The internet mm-hmm. was its own living creature. It became adopted and became the basis of all commerce and business in the world, all interaction in the world, before any regulators could say, hey, we don't like how this is going. And I think that in all likelihood, that's how Bitcoin goes. I will also say there are a lot of intelligent people in this space whose perspective on this is it doesn't really matter what the government does or says, that if the government were to try to ban Bitcoin, the price would shoot up the next day. I like that idea. I'm not sure that it's true. I can tell you, like, my father, who I convinced to buy Bitcoin by explaining to him what it is and how it works and how powerful it is and why he should not be left behind, would immediately sell his Bitcoin if the US government were to ban it. And I think there are a lot of people like that. I think it would be a big setback for retail adoption. So my hope is that this privacy issue doesn't encourage governments or law enforcement agencies to take a harder stance on Bitcoin.
I'm not sure what the timeline is for full privacy within Bitcoin, but I guess similar to you, I'm hoping it will be too late to stop the juggernaut. And because I can imagine if the government banned Bitcoin because it was private, the disruption would be huge, because the Bitcoin tentacles are all through the US economy now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's also, I mean, it's interesting to note they have not taken action against the privacy coins that today are delivering privacy. So you had Ricardo on last week, who I love, mm-hmm. and he has this great quote. So sometime recently, Europol, which is the law enforcement agency for the European Union, came out and said, we are concerned about Monero. I think they said Zcash and Dash too. They said, we're concerned that these products are being adopted by criminals and we can't track them. And Ricardo has this great quote where he says something like, you know, we don't tell criminals to use Monero, but there sure are a lot of benefits for criminals if they do use Monero. So it's like everyone sort of knows that these tools could be adopted for for potentially illicit purposes. And yet the government doesn't seem to be moving against them. We haven't seen bans of Monero, and hopefully we won't. So it could be that my fears are unfounded, and that the desire to have innovation and technical progress will outweigh the desire of the government to have total financial surveillance of all of our conduct. But, you know,
well, criminals still have the on and off ramp issue anyway, for moving significant amounts of money. So I'm pretty sure there'll still be other sophisticated ways of tracking on ramps and not off ramps and who the money's going to. So
okay. Yeah, and also, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think we all know that the idea that Bitcoin is for criminals and money launderers and thieves and nobody else is incorrect. I think the statistic is something like less than 10% or less than 5% of Bitcoin transactions are in any way related to criminal conduct. So I don't think that's the case, but I do think that is the perspective of governments and also the legacy finance industry. I think the same tropes that we've heard for years are the same ones we're going to hear for the next 5 or 10 years, which is Bitcoin is only for criminals and blockchain, not Bitcoin. I think we're stuck with these things for a long time.
Okay, right. Let's talk about ETFs.
Sure.
It's on the radar, on the news every day. What is the path to approval here? Because my assumption is one is going to come at some point, but we have had rejection after rejection. We had 9 recently, I think, in one day. I think do you have one outstanding? What is the path here to approval? What's holding things up?
So I think it's almost certain that eventually an ETF will be approved. I have no idea what the timeline will be on that. The main issue the SEC has is market manipulation. So, you know, the idea of a Bitcoin ETF is to have an ETF share trading on the New York Stock Exchange or a typical regulated exchange that an institutional investor is going to buy, but it's going to reflect the price of the Bitcoin that's trading on these unregulated spot and derivative markets, right? The largest Bitcoin markets are not regulated by the US government. That's both the spot markets where you're actually trading Bitcoin and the derivative markets like BitMEX, for example, where you're trading perpetual swaps, which also affects the price of Bitcoin. The SEC is not going to approve an ETF if they are convinced that the price of that ETF share is going to be impacted significantly by manipulation. And because they don't have insight into what's going on those underlying spot and derivative markets, where the price is being established for Bitcoin, they're just not comfortable approving the ETF yet. So what they said most recently in the denials of the ProShares, Granite Shares, and Direction ETFs last month was that what they need to see is a surveillance sharing agreement with a regulated market of significant size. What that means is they want the ETF sponsor to promise that they are going to deliver to the SEC trading data from those underlying exchanges so that the SEC can see exactly what's going on those order books to satisfy itself that there isn't manipulation or to enable itself to prosecute people who are manipulating those markets. I think it is highly unlikely that Arthur Hayes is going to sign a surveillance sharing agreement with an ETF sponsor in the US. And so I'm not sure how the SEC will be satisfied that enough of the underlying spot and derivative markets are surveilled that they feel comfortable approving an ETF.
Right. Okay. It's quite interesting, the comments of Commissioner Pierce. I think it was yesterday or a few days ago. Also, she seems to be quite a fan of Bitcoin and crypto. Her dissent obviously was picked up by quite a few people. But she said, I don't know if you saw it, but her argument, the SEC's mandate is to focus on determining the quality of the underlying assets. She said it inaccurately focused on the latter during the recent rejection of the Wintelvoss Bitcoin ETF. Did you follow this?
Yeah, I did. And I saw her statement, and I really like her. She has definitely embraced this crypto mom status. I really like her perspective on the role of the SEC, which is that the SEC does need to support innovation. And the SEC's job is not to eliminate all risk for investors, but rather to eliminate unreasonable risk and enable investors to make informed decisions about what kind of risk they want to take on. After all, the nature of the capital markets is for investors to take on risk. So I really like her perspective in general on the SEC's role. I am not sure how legally sound her position is. So I think you articulated it pretty well. What she's saying is the SEC should only look at whether the ETF shares themselves will be manipulated on the exchange where the ETF is being proposed, rather than looking at whether there's going to be manipulation in the underlying markets, even if that manipulation in the underlying markets will affect the ETF price. That perspective goes against about 15 years of SEC precedent. So if you look at the original Winklevoss disapproval order from March of 2017, there's a footnote where they initially make this statement about looking into the underlying markets. And the footnote has a list of dozens of cases dating back to 2004 where, in other opinions, the SEC is looking at the underlying markets for other commodities like gold or oil or other precious metals or what have you. And so while I think her theory is interesting, I would be very surprised if the other commissioners decide to adopt it.
Right. Okay. So back to my original question, path to approval. How long do you think we are away from this? What do you think will actually need to happen before we have an ETF approved?
Well, you know, it's sort of a chicken and an egg problem, because what the SEC wants to have in the market before they approve an ETF is enough liquidity and enough price discovery that they can be confident manipulation won't have a significant impact. But we're not going to get that level of liquidity and price discovery unless we get institutional investors into the space. And it probably takes an ETF to get them into the space. So I think there are sort of two ways of solving this issue. I think the first way is for the Bitcoin markets to simply become less manipulated. I'm not exactly sure how that happens. It may be that the DOJ and the CFTC, which are currently investigating manipulation on crypto exchanges, need to get trading data from those exchanges, launch a few prosecutions, demonstrate that they have some handle on the manipulation going on those exchanges. It may be that Congress needs to give regulatory authority to the SEC or to the CFTC, or maybe even to a brand new agency that is specific to crypto, so that they have the authority to demand trading data from exchanges. But even then, again, Arthur Hayes is probably not going to send trading data to the SEC just because Congress passed a law saying the SEC should get it. So, I'm not sure how that works. I think that the second and more likely outcome is that some ETF sponsor will put together a surveillance sharing agreement with enough exchanges that the SEC will be satisfied it is a significant enough coverage to make them comfortable with their insight into the underlying markets. This is something that the Winklevoss twins are working on right now. They created a new organization. I think it's called the Virtual Commodity Association. It's all of the US exchanges stuck together. I think the theory is if you get a surveillance sharing agreement, at least with all of them, then maybe the SEC will say that's good enough for us to approve an ETF. Really, what I think we need is some turnover in the ranks of the commissioners. So we just got a new commissioner in, this guy, Elad Roisman, who I wouldn't say he's pro-crypto, but he's certainly not anti-crypto. And that's progress, because the guy he replaced certainly was. So it may just be we need some other people in a position of power there who take a different view of this space and are more in favor before we get an ETF approved.
Great. Okay. So look, the last thing I want to talk to you about is BACT. You said this is more important than an ETF. It'd be good to hear your perspective on why that is and why you're so excited about it.
So I think the reason that BACT is more important than an ETF is simply because it's more likely to get approved much faster than an ETF will get approved. So basically what BACT is proposing to do is to launch a one-day physically settled futures contract for Bitcoin. The thing about BACT is one of the companies behind it is the Intercontinental Exchange, ICE, which is a very well-respected, very well-known exchange that owns the New York Stock Exchange, owns about 20 other exchanges, and already has approval from the CFTC to launch futures products. So unlike an ETF, which requires this long and drawn-out approval process with the SEC, BACT can basically self-certify a futures contract and launch it on its own without the CFTC, which is the agency that regulates futures contracts, without the CFTC having to approve it first. Now, granted, if the CFTC doesn't want a futures contract to exist, then it won't. But the CFTC has already shown itself to be willing to allow these kinds of products. We already have futures contracts trading on CBO and CME. So I don't think there's any reason to expect that BACT won't launch in November as they plan to. So I think that simply the fact that we're going to get BACT before we get an ETF is exciting. The second piece of this is BACT is going to roll out in two phases. The first phase is for institutional investors. It's a futures contract where one contract equals one Bitcoin. That's obviously not that useful for merchants or consumers because you can't do business in increments of one Bitcoin. But phase two, it seems, is going to be a product for commercial application, meaning you go to Starbucks, and Starbucks is one of the companies behind BACT. You go to Starbucks, and instead of buying your coffee with Starbucks app, which you've loaded with US dollars, you buy your coffee with Starbucks app, which you've loaded with BACT, which is truly backed by physical Bitcoin. So I think that that possibility is exciting for adoption.
And do you share any of Caitlin Long's concerns about rehypothecation and commingling?
Yeah. Yeah, of course I do. So she's the expert on these issues. She's got 20 years of experience on Wall Street, so she's really the one to talk to about this. But I mean, I can tell you basically what I know about this. Rehypothecation is essentially the same problem as fractional reserve banking. It's a process that creates multiple owners of the same underlying asset, which makes that underlying asset much less stable. A lot of the gold bugs think that this is what has suppressed the price of gold for a long time, or that creating paper claims to assets that don't exist has suppressed the price of gold. I don't think we want to see that in Bitcoin. The problem is Wall Street is going to do what Wall Street does. And if you ask Caitlin, she'll tell you that what Wall Street does is it inflates supply for its own benefit. And so I think, I do think that rehypothecation is an issue. There's an interesting argument that Bitcoin by nature is resistant to rehypothecation because those of us who want Bitcoin will want the real thing, not the rehypothecated version. I think that's an interesting argument, but it's something that's going to have to play out down the road. Commingling is just as much of an issue. So commingling happens when you pledge an asset as collateral to a financial institution, and it throws that asset into a single omnibus account that supports all of the institution's obligations, not just the obligation the institution has made to you, which means in theory, your asset, your Bitcoin, is now collateral for someone else's debt. And if they default, you are the one at risk. So this is another example of something that I think we don't want to see it happen to Bitcoin. This is what we would call bad financialization. But again, it's something that Wall Street gets to do if it wants to launch products and services that do it.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, look, that last question took us to my longest ever podcast. I think you've absolutely crushed it. I think you've done well on such heavy detail over an hour and nearly 20 minutes. So let's just finish up by, is there anything coming up we need to be aware of in the market? And also, After that, can you tell anything that's coming up for you and how people can stay in touch with you?
Yeah, sure. So as far as what I'm watching, sort of like I said, we're all focused on securities enforcement right now. There's a lot more types of enforcement coming down the road. There's anti-money laundering compliance issues we're going to see crop up. There's going to be tax enforcement issues. There's going to be trade sanctions issues. There are going to be trading practices cases, prosecutions of traders who the government is going to say are manipulating these markets. So I think this space is going to expand significantly. And we just have to keep our eyes on all of these agencies to see what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. As far as me, I would say follow me on Twitter at Jay Chervinsky. You can find me on my law firm's website, CobraKim.com. I'm really happy to hear from anyone who wants to reach out to me. I think people who might want to get in touch with me are people who have gotten a subpoena from the U.S. government or think that they might, or people who, generally speaking, have lost money in the crypto space and they think their losses are due to someone else's unlawful conduct and they want to talk to a litigator about getting their money back.
Right. Excellent. This has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on. I can't wait to get this out and see the response, and good luck with everything you do. Next time I'm in Washington, I will meet up with you. We'll grab a beer and have a proper chat in person.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. This was awesome.
Okay, what did you make of that? Did you enjoy it? It's pretty long, right? Pretty long, but Jay's so cool. I mean, we covered so much. I think he was getting pretty tired towards the end, and I think that was probably one of his first podcast interviews, but I think he crushed it. I think he did super well. I thought all the answers were great. I certainly learned from it. I'm hoping that one day I'll get over to DC, sit down with him, have a chat in person, possibly have a beer. But I really appreciate his time. You know, he put in a good hour and 20 minutes in that podcast, and I think it was full of absolute gold dust. You know, especially for someone like me, I sometimes find it harder to understand things than everyone else does. Plus, you know, being in the UK, I don't fully understand the US regulations, and the US seems to be driving forward crypto. But yeah, that was great. It was super cool of Jake. I was really glad to have him on. And yeah, definitely go and follow him on Twitter. Check out the show notes. I've included all his details in there. And yeah, go and follow him. Okay, lastly, please do support the show. Please do check out my Patreon, which is patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Support the show. You can help put money towards my Lambo fund, which no, I'm only kidding. But support the show because it helps me keep this going. Please do share this out on social media. Please do follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Steemit, Medium. I'm at What Bitcoin Did. Check out my website. It's www.whatbitcoindid.com. Sign up to my email. Feel free to reach out to me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And also, a big shout out and a big thanks to my engineer, Jason Camiola. Always pulls it out of the bag for me. If you've got any sound engineering needs, either give me a shout and I'll introduce you to him, or just check out his details in the show notes. Okay, I've got another monster interview coming up this week. Actually, I'm recording it tomorrow and it's my first double interview. Two guests. Hope it goes well. A little bit nervous. I'll let you know who it is soon enough. But yeah, really looking forward to that. Outside of this, hope you all have a great week and I'll see you soon.